A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's living in Israel, he's an English speaker, and he's hit what a lot of people here call the Anglo bubble. You know, the neighborhoods, the social circles, the tradespeople who all just happen to speak English. He says he's torn. On one hand, he wants to deliberately avoid English and push himself into full Hebrew immersion. On the other, he's realized that when an Israeli's English is better than his Hebrew, forcing the Hebrew can actually break communication. So the question is, where do most people actually land on this? And is it even possible to follow through on the immersion ideal? Or do people mostly just hold the position in their head?
This is one of those questions where the stated goal and the revealed behavior diverge so completely that it's practically a case study in human psychology.
Already diagnosing the entire Anglo population.
I'm not diagnosing, I'm observing. There's actual data on this. The immersion ideal is almost universally held. I'd say 90% of English-speaking Olam I've spoken to will tell you within the first year that they want to break out of the bubble, that they didn't move to Israel to live in New Jersey with better hummus. But the follow-through? That's where it gets interesting. Most people plateau.
Plateau at what level, though? Because there's a difference between someone who can order at a restaurant and someone who could argue with a bank.
Right, and that's the crux. The plateau is almost always functional. Hebrew, what linguists call B1 or B2 on the CEFR scale. Enough to handle the mechanic, the doctor, the parent-teacher meeting. Not enough for genuine social intimacy in Hebrew. Not enough to be funny in Hebrew. And that gap between functional and intimate is where the bubble persists.
You're saying people learn enough Hebrew to survive, but not enough to replace English as their social language.
And it's not laziness. The cognitive load of operating in a second language is enormous, even when you're fluent. There was a study out of the University of Haifa a few years back. They looked at Russian-speaking immigrants who'd been here 20, 30 years. Hebrew fluency was high, but in moments of emotional intensity, most still defaulted to Russian. The language of the heart doesn't switch just because your address changed.
Which would explain why even people with solid Hebrew still gravitate toward English-speaking friends. It's not about ability, it's about where you can exhale.
That's the phrase, where you can exhale. And the Anglo bubble is, at its core, an exhalation zone. It's not just language. It's cultural reference points, it's humor, it's knowing that when you say, "That's very on-brand," the person across from you isn't going to tilt their head.
The thing that strikes me about Daniel's framing is that he describes it as an inflection point. Like there's a moment where you either commit or you don't. Is that actually how it works, or is it more of a slow drift?
It's both. There is an inflection point, usually around the 2 to 3 year mark. That's when the novelty of being an immigrant wears off. The initial Ulpan Hebrew is no longer sufficient, and you have to make active choices about where you live, where you work, who you socialize with. But after that inflection point, it becomes a slow drift. Most people drift toward comfort. The bubble isn't something you join, it's something you fail to leave.
Like falling asleep in a warm room. You don't decide to nap, you just stop deciding not to.
Then you wake up 5 years later and realize your plumber, your accountant, your kid's best friend's parents, and your book club are all from the same 3 English-speaking countries.
The just happens, multiplying. That was the phrase Daniel used, and it's the most honest description of how bubbles form that I've heard. Nobody sets out to build one. You hire a plumber who was recommended. He happens to be South African. You don't think twice. Then you need an electrician. The plumber recommends someone. They're from Manchester. The pattern is invisible until it's already your entire life.
Each individual decision is rational. That's what makes it so insidious. You're not choosing English speakers. You're choosing convenience, reliability, word-of-mouth trust. The language commonality is just the substrate those things grow on.
Let's get to the practical question. The deliberate immersion part. Daniel says he's tried to avoid English entirely, but finds it breaks down when the Israeli's English is better than his Hebrew. Where do most people land on this?
Most people land exactly where Daniel is, torn. The all-or-nothing approach almost never works. I've seen people try it. They announce they're speaking only Hebrew from now on. They make it about 3 days. They have one conversation where something important got misunderstood, and they quietly revert. The people who succeed at integration don't go all or nothing. They go domain by domain.
Domain by domain. Break that down.
Instead of, I will speak only Hebrew, it's, I will handle all my bureaucracy in Hebrew. Or, I will join a gym where the classes are in Hebrew. Or, I will read the Hebrew newspaper, not the English one, for my daily news. You carve out specific domains of life where Hebrew is the rule, and you protect them. But you don't pretend you're going to discuss your mortgage terms in broken Hebrew with a banker who speaks perfect English.
Because the communication loss is real.
It's not just real, it's consequential. There are domains where precision matters more than practice. Medical conversations, legal matters, anything involving large sums of money, the cost of a misunderstanding in Hebrew outweighs the benefit of the practice. Acknowledging that isn't weakness, it's triage.
The mature position isn't avoid English, it's be strategic about where Hebrew earns its place.
And the people I've seen who've integrated most successfully tend to have about 3 or 4 Hebrew domains that expand over time. Work is often the biggest one. If you work in a Hebrew-speaking office, that's 8 hours a day of forced immersion. It's exhausting for the first 6 months, and then it's just...
That's the catch, isn't it? A lot of English speakers in Israel work in English. The tech sector is practically Anglophone. If your professional life is in English, you've already lost the biggest immersion opportunity.
That's why the Anglo bubble is concentrated in certain professions. High tech, academia, certain branches of law, journalism, fields where English is either the working language or heavily present. If you're a software engineer at a Tel Aviv startup, your stand-ups might be in Hebrew, but your documentation is in English. Your conferences are in English, and half your colleagues made Alia from the same 3 countries you did.
I've noticed that the bubble is also geographically concentrated. Ra'anana, Modi'in, parts of Jerusalem like Baca and the German colony, certain neighborhoods in Tel Aviv. You can map the bubble by postal code.
Ra'anana is the canonical example. Something like 20% of Ra'anana's population is English-speaking Olam. You can live your entire life there in English, schools, shops, municipal services. The city actually provides translated materials. It's not a bug, it's a feature. Ra'anana made itself a soft landing zone deliberately.
There's a real argument for that, especially in the first year or two. Moving countries is destabilizing enough without also being linguistically helpless. The soft landing prevents the kind of isolation that makes people give up and go back.
The research on immigrant retention bears this out. Countries that provide linguistic bridging services, translated forms, interpreters, language concordant healthcare, have higher long-term integration rates, not lower. The bridge isn't a crutch, it's a scaffold. You use it while you build the real structure.
The Anglo bubble isn't the problem. It's staying in the Anglo bubble past its useful life that's the problem.
The bubble is a perfectly good first apartment. You just don't want to still be there when your kids are in high school.
The question is when past its useful life kicks in. Daniel seems to be at that point now, feeling like he's somewhere in the middle. What's the actual timeline for most people?
Based on what I've observed, and there's some survey data from Nefesh B'Nefesh on this, the first 2 years, the bubble is protective. Years 3 to 5, it starts feeling constricting. By year 7 or 8, people either break out or make peace with staying in. The ones who make peace with it often reframe it. I have Israeli friends at work. My Hebrew is fine for daily life. My kids are fully integrated, so it doesn't matter.
Are they wrong? If your kids are in Israeli schools, speaking Hebrew natively, serving in the army, hasn't the integration happened already, just intergenerationally?
That's the most generous reading, and there's some truth to it. The first generation often sacrifices full integration so the second generation doesn't have to. But I think that's a partial story. The first generation immigrant who stays in the bubble also misses things. The depth of Israeli cultural life, the ability to participate in public discourse, the sense of full citizenship that comes from reading the news in Hebrew and understanding the political satire and getting the puns.
There's a difference between living in a country and inhabiting it.
That distinction is the whole thing. Inhabiting a country means you're part of the conversation, not just physically present while it happens around you. And you can do that from inside a linguistic bubble, no matter how pleasant the bubble is.
What about the deliberate immersion approach that Daniel mentioned? The avoid anything English-speaking strategy? You said it usually fails. Is there a version of it that works?
The version that works is asymmetric immersion. You make Hebrew the default for output. You speak Hebrew whenever you can, even badly, but you don't deprive yourself of English input. You still read in English, listen to podcasts in English, consume media in English. The goal isn't to become a monoglot. The goal is to make Hebrew your primary spoken interface with the country.
You're not trying to forget English. You're trying to make Hebrew the language you reach for when you open your mouth in public.
And that's a much more achievable goal than full linguistic replacement. It also respects something that the all-or-nothing crowd often misses. Your English isn't just a convenience, it's part of who you are. You think in English, you dream in English, your inner monologue is in English. Trying to suppress that is like trying to suppress your own thoughts.
There's something almost puritanical about the immersion absolutists. Like they've turned language acquisition into a moral test.
That moral framing creates unnecessary guilt. I've met people who've been here 15 years, run successful businesses, raised Israeli kids, contributed to their communities, and they still feel inadequate because their Hebrew has an accent or they can't read a novel in Hebrew. The guilt is the real waste product of the Anglo-bubble discourse.
Guilt is the true carbon emission of incomplete integration.
That's a very corn way to put it, but yes.
Let me ask you something that might be uncomfortable. Is the Anglo-bubble actually worse for integration than, say, the Russian-speaking bubble or the French-speaking bubble? Or is it just more visible because English is the global language?
It's different in kind, not just degree. The Russian-speaking bubble in Israel is large and persistent. There are entire cities where Russian is the dominant language, newspapers, television channels, cultural institutions. But Russian speakers in Israel are generally not in a position where Israelis are switching to their language to accommodate them. An Israeli bank teller doesn't switch to Russian when they hear an accent. They do switch to English.
Because English is the prestige language.
It's the global default. And that means English speakers never hit the same wall that speakers of other languages hit. A French immigrant who wants to open a bank account has no choice but to use Hebrew or find a French-speaking teller, which is much harder. An English speaker walks in, starts fumbling in Hebrew, and the teller says, "It's okay, I speak English." The escape hatch is always open.
The escape hatch. That's the structural problem. The immersion absolutists want to nail the escape hatch shut, but the world keeps prying it open for you.
It's not just Israelis being helpful. English is genuinely the most efficient communication channel between an English speaker with intermediate Hebrew and a Hebrew speaker with intermediate English. The combined fluency is highest in English. Choosing Hebrew in that situation isn't immersion. It's deliberately choosing the worst tool for the job.
Which is why Daniel's point about practicality lands. If the Israeli's English is better than your Hebrew, forcing Hebrew can degrade the communication.
Communication isn't just about transferring information. It's about building relationships. If you're struggling through Hebrew while the other person is patiently decoding your grammar errors, you're not connecting. You're performing. The connection happens when you switch to the shared language and actually talk.
We've arrived at a paradox. The bubble is bad, but the escape from the bubble is also sometimes bad. Immersion is good, but forced immersion can break communication. Where does that leave someone like Daniel?
It leaves them with a portfolio approach. Some relationships in Hebrew, some in English, some bilingual. Some domains in Hebrew, some in English. The goal isn't purity, it's balance. And balance that shifts over time toward more Hebrew, not less.
The people who successfully navigate this, what do they actually do differently?
A few things. One, they don't make language the primary axis of friendship. They make shared interest the axis and let the language follow. Join a hiking group because you like hiking, not because it's in Hebrew. The Hebrew will come as a side effect of the shared activity.
Language is vehicle, not destination.
Two, they're willing to be bad at Hebrew in public. This is the biggest psychological barrier. Adults hate feeling incompetent. Speaking a new language makes you sound like a child. The people who break out of the bubble are the ones who accept that they will sound foolish for years and do it anyway.
The willingness to be the least articulate person in the room.
And three, And this is the one that most advice misses. They find Hebrew content they actually enjoy, not Hebrew content that's good for them, not news broadcasts and educational podcasts. Content they would consume even if they weren't trying to learn the language.
Trashy reality TV, basically.
The people I know with the best Hebrew are the ones who got hooked on some Israeli show and watched 6 seasons of it. Not because they were practicing, but because they wanted to know what happened next. The language acquisition was a side effect of genuine engagement.
That's actually a useful heuristic. If your only Hebrew exposure is things you consume out of obligation, you're doing it wrong.
Obligation-based learning has a ceiling, and it's a low one. Interest-based learning has no ceiling. You'll sit through hours of content you'd never touch if it were framed as practice.
What about the structural things? Where you live, where you work? Those are bigger decisions than what TV you watch.
Much bigger, and they're where the real sorting happens. If you move to a heavily Anglo neighborhood, you're choosing a certain ceiling on your Hebrew exposure. That's not a moral failing, but it is a choice with consequences. The people who end up with native-level Hebrew almost always made at least one big structural choice. Living in a Hebrew-dominant area, working in a Hebrew-speaking workplace, or marrying into a Hebrew-speaking family.
Marriage is the nuclear option for language acquisition.
It's the most effective immersion program ever invented, and it comes with the minor side effect of a lifelong commitment. But seriously, mixed language couples, where one partner is a native Hebrew speaker and the other isn't, those are the people whose Hebrew tends to be strongest. You can't fake your way through a marriage in your second language.
Although I've seen couples where the native Hebrew speaker just switches to English and never switches back, and the Anglo partner's Hebrew actually atrophies.
That's the other outcome, and it's surprisingly common. If the Hebrew-speaking partner is comfortable in English, the couple often defaults to English and stays there. The Hebrew partner becomes part of the bubble, rather than the exit from it.
Which brings us back to the escape hatch. Even marriage doesn't close it.
Nothing closes it. That's the reality that the immersion absolutists don't want to accept. English is too useful, too widespread, too deeply embedded in Israeli society. The question isn't whether you'll use English. You will. The question is whether English is your only language or one of two.
The realistic endpoint isn't monolingual Hebrew. It's functional bilingualism with English still dominant in intimate contexts.
For most people, yes. And I want to be clear, that's fine. That's a successful immigration outcome. You've learned the language well enough to navigate the country independently. You've built a life here. You're contributing. The idea that you need to achieve native-level Hebrew to have really integrated is a standard almost nobody meets, in any immigration context, anywhere.
The really integrated standard is a phantom. It's always defined as whatever the person setting the standard has achieved, or whatever they feel guilty about not achieving.
It ignores how actual multilingual societies work. Go to Switzerland. People switch between languages constantly based on context and convenience. Nobody's wringing their hands about whether they've truly integrated into the German-speaking canton because they still speak French at home.
Israel is a little different, though, because Hebrew is such a central part of the national project. The revival of Hebrew as a spoken language is one of the defining stories of modern Israel. There's a cultural weight to Hebrew that goes beyond mere communication.
That's absolutely true, and it's part of why the Anglo-bubble discourse is so charged. You're not just learning a language, you're participating in the revival of a language. Refusing to learn Hebrew well enough isn't just inconvenient, it's seen as a rejection of the national project itself.
Which is a lot of pressure to put on someone who's just trying to get their internet installed.
It creates exactly the guilt dynamic we were talking about. The cultural significance of Hebrew gets weaponized, sometimes by others, often by the immigrant's own inner critic. I moved to the Jewish state, and I can't even read a novel in the language of the Jewish state. That's a heavy thought to carry.
Do you think the guilt is productive? Does it actually motivate people to improve? Or does it just make them feel bad while changing nothing?
In my experience, guilt is a terrible motivator for language learning. It creates avoidance, not engagement. People don't study Hebrew because they feel bad about not knowing Hebrew. They study Hebrew because they have a reason to. A job, a relationship, a TV show, a community they want to be part of. Positive motivation beats negative motivation every time.
The advice to someone at Daniel's inflection point would be, stop feeling guilty and start finding reasons to want Hebrew rather than reasons you should want it.
And be honest about where you are. If you're in year 4 and your Hebrew is still at the survival level, something structural probably needs to change. Not your attitude, your circumstances, your job, your neighborhood, your social circle. The attitude shift alone won't do it.
What about the people who just stay in the bubble? The ones who hit year 10 and still live their lives primarily in English. Is that a failure or is it just a different choice?
I think calling it a failure is ungenerous and also inaccurate. These are people who moved countries, built careers, raised families, navigated a foreign bureaucracy, often in a second language. That's an extraordinary achievement, even with a linguistic bubble. But I do think they miss something. They miss the texture of Israeli life that's only available in Hebrew. The humor, the slang, the cultural references, the way Israelis talk to each other when they're not accommodating an English speaker.
That's a good word for it. You can live in a country and still only touch its surface.
Some people are fine with that. They didn't move here for the texture, they moved here for other reasons. Religious, ideological, economic, family. The texture is nice to have, not essential. I'm not going to tell those people they're doing it wrong.
For someone who's not fine with it, someone who's at the inflection point and feeling the pull toward deeper integration, the path is structural changes where possible, asymmetric immersion where structural changes aren't possible, and finding Hebrew content you enjoy.
Years of patience. The people I know with the best Hebrew as a second language are the ones who've been here 15-20 years and just kept at it. Not intensively, not obsessively, just consistently. A little bit every day, over decades. That's how language acquisition actually works for adults.
The sloth approach to Hebrew fluency.
I was wondering when you'd find a way to make this about you.
I'm just saying, slow and steady has its merits.
It does, and that's actually a good note to land on. The people who burn out on immersion are the ones who try to do it all at once. The people who succeed are the ones who treat it as a marathon, not a sprint. They're okay with being bad at Hebrew for years. They're okay with using English when it's the better tool. They don't let the perfect be the enemy of the functional.
They stop apologizing for their accent.
An accent is not a moral failing. It's evidence that you speak more than one language. The fact that you have an accent in Hebrew means you already did the hard thing. You learned another language well enough to live in it. That's not something to apologize for.
To bring it back to Daniel's question, where do most people end up? They end up bilingual and asymmetrical. Hebrew for the public sphere, English for the private sphere. Hebrew for transactions, English for intimacy. And over time, the boundary shifts. But it shifts.
The people who feel stuck in the middle, which is where Daniel says he is, are probably exactly where they should be. The middle isn't a failure state, it's the transition zone. You're not in the bubble anymore, and you're not a native speaker. You're in between. And in between is where the actual integration happens.
In between is where the actual integration happens. I'd put that on a poster if I believed in motivational posters.
You'd put it on a poster and then fall asleep under it.
The poster would be in English, obviously. Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1940s, Soviet scientists discovered a subglacial lake under the Inalchek Glacier in Kyrgyzstan. If you drained that lake, you'd have enough water to fill roughly 40 billion samovars, which is, for reference, about one samovar for every 5 people who have ever lived.
Right?
I'll be thinking about samovars for the rest of the day.
So, to close this out, if there's one thing to take from this conversation, it's that the Anglo bubble isn't the cage you're trapped in. It's a room you can walk out of whenever you want. You just have to be willing to sound a little foolish, be a little uncomfortable, and keep walking even when the escape hatch keeps opening behind you. And also, maybe watch some terrible Israeli reality TV.
The terrible TV is essential. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for the fact and the samovar math. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you've got a minute, leave us a review. It helps more than you'd think.
We'll be back next week. Try to stay out of bubbles. Unless they're literal bubbles. Those are fine.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.